Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Francine Foss and Anish Chagpar. Dr. Foss is a professor of medical oncology and dermatology specializing in the treatment of lymphomas. Dr. Chagpar is associate professor of surgical oncology and director of the Breast Center at Smilow Cancer Hospital at Yale New Haven. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This week, Dr. Foss is joined by Dr. Sajid Khan. Dr. Khan is assistant professor of surgical oncology at the Yale School of Medicine, and he joins us this evening for a conversation about surgical options for GI cancers. Here's Francine Foss.
Let's start off by having you tell us a little bit about yourself. How long have you been at Yale, and what was your training before you came here?
Well, I recently started working for Yale just this past summer, and I'm a surgical oncologist. I completed my general surgery residency at the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, Oregon, and I completed clinical and research fellowships at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center and at the University of Chicago. My clinical focus is primarily on gastrointestinal cancers, and my research focus looks at molecular and clinical features of patients with a low burden of metastasis or oligometastasis in order to identify patients who can truly benefit from a surgical resection. As a member of the Yale Department of Surgery, I was recruited by Dr. Rob Utelsman and Dr. Ron Salem to extend the services of Yale's Section of Surgical Oncology to Bridgeport Hospital and the surrounding Fairfield County. And we hope that my presence there will allow individuals in the city of Bridgeport and Fairfield County in general more convenient access to Yale surgery and to recapitulate the high quality of cancer care, including the multidisciplinary care of our patients.
So that's a place where we can start off our discussion, which is, can you integrate for us medical oncology, surgical oncology, and the whole multidisciplinary approach at the Yale Cancer Center? How does that all work?
So I'm glad you mentioned that. So one of the reasons actually I went into surgical oncology is because of the multidisciplinary care that's required to take care of each individual patient. Regularly, patients that I see in clinic will be presented at a GI tumor board where experts in medical oncology, gastroenterology, pathology, radiology, genetics, social work, a whole team of people collaborate together and discuss each patient and decide who will benefit from what kind of therapy. So it's not just the surgeon calling the shots, or it's not just one particular discipline calling the shots. It's all of us working as a team to provide that care. And I think that's a pretty valuable thing, and I think it's a pretty valuable thing.
As a medical oncologist, to me, the surgical oncologist is oftentimes the first portal of entry because a lot of patients with solid tumors present through a surgeon. Can you talk a little bit about that and how you first encounter a patient and what that's all like, and then how you make a referral from there on to the other disciplines?
Great. I'm glad you asked that. Many times a patient will have an incidental finding on a CAT scan for a trauma or for a reason that wasn't actually a cancer, and they didn't even know what was for a different reason than what they actually expected. So if I see a patient in my clinic, I actually present every one of my patients at our GI tumor boards, and we actually run GI tumor boards here at Yale New Haven, but we also run them in Bridgeport as well, too. So I will submit my each patient and allow all the experts in the various disciplines of oncology to learn about the patient, and then we decide as a team what the best thing to do is for that individual. So
your major focus is GI cancers. Can we backtrack and have you tell us a little bit about what those cancers are?
Sure. So the GI cancers that I treat are essentially all cancers of the gastrointestinal tract, and they include cancers of the esophagus, gastric cancers, gastrointestinal stromal tumors, which are cancers that we'll talk a little bit more about later, which can occur in the stomach or the small intestine or other GI tract parts of the GI tract, pancreatic cancer and premalignant pancreatic tumors, colorectal cancer, liver metastases, hepatocellular carcinoma, cholangiocarcinoma, which is a cancer of the bile ducts, gallbladder cancer, and colorectal cancer. And, you know, thus far, I have to say, if you'd have to ask me if there's a specific type of cancer I've seen more, actually there isn't. I've seen actually a relatively even distribution of all of these cancers so far in my practice.
Can you tell us how common any of these cancers are? What's the most common out of that group, and what's the least common?
Sure. I would say colon cancer is probably colon or rectal cancers are the most common within that group. You know, many patients, and one of the reasons for that, and I think we'll talk a little bit about screening colonoscopies a little bit later, has to do with cancers that are picked up on screening screening studies. And colon cancer is actually one of the few GI cancers that we actually have a great screening modality for. So I think that's a very good thing. Some of the cancers that are a little bit more rare are cancers of the bile ducts or what's called a cholangiocarcinoma. Those are often picked up a little bit more of at an advanced stage, and patients are often amenable to a surgical cure, which is unfortunate. So I think when we learn to have better screening modalities, I think that will help pick up some of these other cancers at an earlier time.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the screening since you brought it up. Colon cancer is one of the top cancers for both men and women in the United States. And as you alluded to, we actually do have screening tools and perhaps can prevent the more advanced cases. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. And so like you mentioned a little bit, so there are screening options available for some of the GI cancers, but, you know, in my opinion, there's not enough. And I think we have to do better as a medical community in this arena because the earlier cancer is detected, the better the chances for cure. So a colonoscopy is an excellent example of a good screening modality for GI cancers. Unfortunately, colon cancer is the only GI cancer where all individuals can undergo screening by a certain age and actually have some benefit. So all average-risk patients should have their first screening colonoscopy beginning at the age of 50, and patients with an increased risk or high-risk syndromes should be screened at an earlier age. Patients with Barrett's esophagus are recommended to undergo upper endoscopy screening for esophageal problems as well, too, or esophageal tumors or malignancies, and the recommendations vary based on the presence or absence of atypical findings. And patients with risk factors for hepatocellular carcinoma are the third type of GI cancers that we have some sort of a screening modality for. So hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer, patients that are at risk for developing hepatocellular carcinoma include patients with cirrhosis or from chronic inflammatory problems of the liver, which include hepatitis C and B, alcoholism, and non-alcoholic steatohepatitis, just to name a few. And I'll just quickly make a quick side comment, but non-alcoholic steatohepatitis is a relatively newer entity that we're dealing with, and that is a type of hepatitis that patients could get from obesity, and obesity is becoming a big problem in this country, so I think it's something we just should all be aware of. But going back to the screening, so individuals with these kinds of risk factors should undergo screening liver ultrasounds and alpha fetoprotein levels, which is a tumor marker, every 6 to 12 months.
So, and you just mentioned this steatohepatitis and obesity. With the obesity epidemic in the United States, how should we be screening those patients? Should every patient, when they go to their primary care physician after a certain age, you know, who's obese, get these kinds of screening tests?
I wish I had a great answer for you, but we have to find out what the appropriate way to screen for these individuals are. I think in the long run, for a lot of the screening studies, we're going to be able to identify certain risk factors and use in conjunction the current modalities that we have, such as ultrasound or some sort of a GI study or an endoscopy to screen patients and find out who we can catch the liver cancer early enough. But I don't have a great answer for you for that, Francine.
Can we also talk a little bit about the colon cancer screening again? You mentioned that over age 50, people start getting colonoscopies unless they have risk factors. Can you talk about what those risk factors are that would indicate that people under age 50 should start getting screened?
Sure. So some of the factors that increase an individual's risk are individuals that have inflammatory bowel diseases or Crohn's disease or ulcerative colitis. So those individuals should talk to their physician or their gastroenterologist to ask about early screening. There's also patients, about 5% of patients with colon cancer actually have a known high-risk syndrome. And the two ones that we always think about are FAP or familial adenomatous polyposis, which is an individual that has thousands of polyps carpeting their colon, or HNPCC, or what's called Lynch syndrome. So those are high-risk syndromes that also should be screened at an earlier age.
You also mentioned Barrett's esophagus, and I wonder if you could clarify that for the audience. What is that disease? Who does it occur in? And what is the screening that would be necessary if you have that?
So Barrett's esophagus is essentially a change in the histological features of an individual's esophagus. And not to sound too technical, but the esophagus generally is made of a squamous epithelium, and it turns into a columnar or a different kind of it looks different under a microscope, and it actually looks different when a gastroenterologist is scoping a patient. And Barrett's esophagus is a risk factor for the development of esophageal cancer. Patients that have low-grade dysplasia have a higher risk of developing esophageal cancer, but not high enough where they need surgery. So patients that have low-grade dysplasia found in a background of Barrett's should undergo more frequent screening endoscopies. Those with high-grade dysplasia, at that point, we're thinking, do they need an aggressive endoscopic intervention or sometimes even surgery?
So a lot of the cancers we're talking about, it sounds like you could pick them up with appropriate screening. But can you tell us, in your practice, how often do people come in with cancers that weren't picked up with screening and or just present with some manifestations of the cancer?
I'm a surgical oncologist, and as a surgical oncologist, a lot of times I don't see patients that have very advanced disease. I usually are referred patients meet patients that actually have a potential for cure. So I often see patients that are amenable to a surgical cure. But I'm probably not the best person to assess that question.
So if a patient does actually get to the point where they weren't picked up with screening and they actually have a cancer, can you talk about what the clinical presentation is for many of these patients? Do they have symptoms, in other words, and what are those symptoms?
Sure. So that's a pretty broad question, and there's different answers depending on the type of cancer that we talk about. So some are fortunate and they present with the screening modality, and then that's a good thing. Some are found incidentally on a CAT scan, and that could be a good thing too. But unfortunately, a lot of patients with gastric cancers actually present with disease that are too advanced for a surgical cure. And in the United States, that's actually too often the case in patients with esophageal cancer, gastric cancer, pancreatic cancers, and the cancers of the bile ducts. So some non-specific symptoms of GI cancers, and I must stress that they can also be for non-cancer problems also, are weight loss, decreased appetite, or abdominal pain. But some specific symptoms in regards to particular cancers, some patients with esophageal cancer could present with difficulty swallowing gradually. Patients with gastric and esophageal cancer could present with upper abdominal discomfort or pain, the sensation of fullness or bloating after eating, and they can also present to their primary care doctor with anemia, which is because of a chronic bleed from their tumor. Patients with pancreatic cancer, cholangiocarcinoma, or cancer of the bile ducts, and liver cancer can present with jaundice, itching, yellowing of the eyes, or some upper abdominal pain or discomfort. And then we talked a little bit about colon cancer being picked up from screening, but can also be picked up by patients that have bleeding from their blood per rectum.
So how often can you actually make the diagnosis without surgery, or is the diagnosis made in many cases when you operate?
So that's a great question. A lot of times the diagnosis is made before surgery, or we have a pretty good idea. We don't know 100% of the time, I would say, until the tumor or the structure that's at concern is out and the pathologist will look at that under a slide. However, that being said, CAT scans and MRIs are outstanding today. And many times patients won't even need a biopsy. There's some specific findings that go along with the particular GI cancers that the surgical oncologist or the radiologist will look at together and know that it's something to be worried about. And sometimes we'll take someone to the operating room without a tissue diagnosis and very suspicious, and they probably will have the problem that we were looking for in the beginning.
Well, great. Let's talk a little bit more after the break about some of the specific surgical options and some of your research. We're going to take a brief break right now for a medical minute. Please stay tuned to learn more about surgical options for GI cancers with our guest, Dr. Sajid Khan.
There are over 12 million cancer survivors in the U.S. right now, and the numbers keep growing. Completing treatment for cancer is a very exciting milestone, but cancer and its treatment can be a life-changing experience. The return to normal activities and relationships may be difficult, and cancer survivors may face other long-term side effects of cancer, including heart problems, osteoporosis, fertility issues, and an increased risk of second cancers. Resources for cancer survivors are available at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale Cancer Center, to keep cancer survivors well and focused on healthy living. This has been a Medical Minute, brought to you as a public service by Yale Cancer Center. More information is available at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum on the Connecticut Public Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Francine Foss, and I'm joined today by my guest, Dr. Khan. And we're here discussing surgical options for GI cancers. We talked a little bit in detail about some of the specific kinds of GI cancer and your approach to those patients, but I wonder if you could now step us through the whole process. So a patient comes in, they have a diagnosis of a GI cancer, they see you. Can you step us through what actually happens next?
Okay, that's a great and very important question, Francine. So I think the most important thing for any cancer patient or a GI cancer patient, I think this applies to a lot of other cancers too, is multidisciplinary care. And that's actually one of the big reasons I actually chose to specialize in surgical oncology as opposed to other disciplines in surgery. In all solid tumors, and specifically in relationship to GI cancers, it cannot be emphasized enough that patients should all be addressed and assessed in a multidisciplinary approach. And that is how myself and my partners at Yale Surgical Oncology treat all of our patients. And this certainly holds true with all the patients I see at Bridgeport Hospital. Having the expert opinion of all disciplines of oncology provides patients with the best possible outcomes. And when I say multidisciplinary care, let me talk about what I mean a little bit more. I mean that experts from various disciplines of oncology regularly meet in a room and discuss each patient that we all see in our clinics with the GI cancer. And all of us put our heads together and come up with a consensus opinion or consensus statement on what we think the best possible treatment for that patient would be. In some cases, that involves surgery first and then thinking about chemo and/or radiation therapy afterwards. Sometimes it involves starting with chemotherapy and radiation therapy first, or I should say chemotherapy and/or radiation therapy first, and then forging ahead with surgery later. And I think that's the trend for a lot of cancers these days, because it actually helps identify which patients will benefit from surgery, and it also allows us to figure out a little bit more about the biology of the cancer that we're dealing with.
So it's really, really important that you have all of these disciplines involved, particularly if it would benefit a patient to get one of these other modalities before you operate.
Absolutely, Francine.
Can I ask a question about the evolution of surgery in the context of GI cancers? I know that there's a lot of laparoscopic surgery being done now for other conditions, and I'm wondering, in the setting of cancer, are those kinds of relatively non-invasive approaches things that you're doing?
They are things that I'm doing, and my partners are doing as well, too. So many of the tumors can be dealt with in a minimally invasive or laparoscopic. Laparoscopy is one aspect of minimally invasive surgery. Sometimes if we see tumors of the pancreas, when they're at a particular location, they could be amenable to a laparoscopic or a minimally invasive resection. The same can be said of colon cancer. Colon cancer, about 15 years ago, every patient with colon cancer was treated with a laparotomy or a big abdominal incision, but now many patients with colon cancer can be treated with a laparoscopic or a minimally invasive approach. So it's there, but it doesn't mean we need to overstep our bounds with it either. Some patients, I think, are better off not having a minimally invasive approach. A lot of times, I would say there's a minimally invasive approach involved in a lot of our GI cancer operations, but sometimes it's involved in part of the operation where we will take a quick look with the laparoscope to make sure that the patient doesn't have any evidence of any distant metastasis before forging ahead with a bigger abdominal operation. So it's the right balance, and we should be aware of that.
Do you feel overall that GI surgery is tolerated better, that patients recover quicker nowadays due to some of the newer techniques?
Yeah, I would say that. And a big part of that is laparoscopy or the minimally invasive surgery. Patients will some operations that are well studied, which include colon cancer and some operations of the pancreas with the laparoscopy, patients will end up leaving the hospital sooner if they undergo a minimally invasive approach, and patients will require less pain medications also if they undergo a minimally invasive approach.
And also they'll be able to start their other therapy, be it chemo or radiation or whatever else they're going to do sooner, I would presume.
That's correct, yeah.
You had mentioned a tumor called a GIST tumor earlier, and we haven't talked about that one yet. I wonder if you could fill us in on what that is.
Sure, Francine. GIST stands for gastrointestinal stromal tumors, and it's a relatively uncommon cancer with about 5,000 cases diagnosed each year in the United States. It's a soft tissue tumor as opposed to an epithelial tumor, which is what we often see, and it mostly occurs in the stomach at 60% of its cases, and 30% of the time it'll occur in the small intestine, and then it can occur at other parts of the GI tract too. This is a good example of multimodality treatment. So when the disease is non-metastatic, the treatment generally starts with the surgical resection, and that usually involves a wedge resection or a segmental resection of the organ that's involved. And we just hope to take the tumor out with an intact capsule, pseudocapsule, without any lymph node dissection. So it's not uncommon for GISTs. We talked a little bit about minimally invasive or laparoscopic surgery before. It's not uncommon for GISTs just to be able to be amenable to laparoscopic resection because we're just taking out just essentially a segment or a wedge of a tumor as opposed to an entire organ, and that's usually a little bit easier to do laparoscopically. And myself and my partners at Yale actually try to do that when we can with GIST tumors when they're in a favorable anatomic location. So let's talk about a little bit about multidisciplinary care here. So after the surgeon resects the tumor, the pathologist, who's also critical in oncology care, analyzes the tumor. And what we care most about is the size of the tumor and what it looks like under the microscope. We look at those characteristics, or the medical oncologist will look at those characteristics and decide if patients will benefit from from adjuvant therapy or given therapy after surgery. And what we think of here a lot of times is imatinib. So it's just worth pausing a minute and just to discuss imatinib for a bit, because imatinib is one of the most important cancer drugs that are available. So imatinib is a targeted drug and actually inhibits what's called a KIT or a tyrosine kinase receptor, which is mutated in about 90% of cases of GIST. Actually, imatinib was actually invented where I did my residency out in Oregon. And it's actually one of the first targeted drugs that was shown to specifically act on an identified mutation, and it actually, that's what the science showed initially. And actually, within the last 10 years, there's been trials to support that, and it shows that patients that actually are treated with GIST with certain characteristics will actually have a good clinical benefit. I guess the last way to manage GIST is sometimes a tumor is too big and surgery is probably not the best thing to start with. And forging ahead with surgery would involve a big operation that would resect organs that, you know, if you can save, it would be nice to do. And sometimes patients are given the the biologic therapy or the imatinib before surgery, and the tumor will have a chance to be shrunken, and then the surgeon can go ahead and do a less extensive operation. So that's a good example of multidisciplinary care, and you can't have that unless all the experts in oncology are sitting in a room together discussing each patient every individually.
I think that GIST story is particularly interesting because the imatinib actually comes from my neck of the woods as a hematologist. It was originally developed for patients with CML that expressed the BCR-ABL. And so I'm wondering, how did it get from hematology into GI tumors? I mean, how did that happen that somebody identified the mutation and suggested that it might be useful in the GIST tumor?
I wouldn't be telling the truth if I pretend I knew the entire story behind it. I don't.
It seems interesting, though, that one can identify a pathway. So this targets a specific pathway, a molecular pathway, and it shows you that you can take these targeted agents from one tumor to another. Can you talk about other potential targeting therapies in GI cancer? Are there other paradigms like this that are being developed?
Yes, there are. So a couple of good ones some of the stuff that I've studied, some of my research has been on colon cancer, and a really good example is the use of cetuximab or panitumumab on patients with metastatic colon cancer. Essentially, patients can have a mutation in what's called the KRAS gene, which is a particular gene in colon cancer, And individuals that don't have a mutation in that gene benefit from treatment with cetuximab because it actually targets this pathway. Another good example of this is patients with gastric cancer. So the HER2 amplification is a big story in breast cancer, but recently it's actually shown to be have a big story in gastric cancer too. 20% of patients with gastric cancer actually have HER2 amplification, and they were given a drug that works in this HER2 pathway, and they actually were found to have a good survival benefit. So this applies to different types of GI cancers, and that's why Gleevec or imatinib, which is the actual name for it, is such an important drug, because I think it paved the way for in the GI oncology community to look at, to try to recapitulate this the use of it in other kinds of cancers.
So you've actually done some work in your research looking at some of the molecular biology behind these tumors and metastases and how to deal with that situation clinically. Can you fill us in a little bit on what you've been doing?
Sure. I love talking about my research. And so many times when patients have metastasis, they're actually not seen by a surgical oncologist. A lot of times the patients will need systemic chemotherapy and they're not surgical candidates. But there are a subgroup of patients with metastasis that will benefit from a local therapy, which can include a surgical resection or stereotactic radiotherapy. So I'm interested in, and right now, the way those patients are identified and selected for surgery is purely looking at clinical characteristics. What my research focuses on is looking at the molecular characteristics of patients with these metastases, with these limited number of metastases, or called so-called oligometastasis. So I was fortunate enough during my fellowship to be working for Ralph Wechselbaum and Sam Hellman in their lab, and those are the two physicians that came up with the term of oligometastasis. And we actually found that looking at certain molecular markers, something called microRNAs, certain microRNAs were looked at and identified patients with a limited number of metastasis, and those are patients that we hope to identify to treat them with a surgical resection. So to try to use a combination, not just the clinical data, we'd like to use molecular data in addition to clinical data to select patients for surgical resection.
So you're talking about these microRNAs. Can you just very briefly tell our audience what this is and like what's the actual technique you use to detect these? Do you do this in the tumor tissue and the metastatic tissue? And how do you actually get the information?
So technology is pretty advanced these days with molecular biology. And what we actually, some of these studies that were done involve actually taking patient tumor tissue, metastatic tumor tissue at times, and sometimes we look at the primary tumor, and actually examine each patient's tumor for these microRNAs and see what their expression of these microRNAs are. And we compared patients with good outcomes and patients with bad outcomes, and unfortunately, and we try to look at microRNAs that are associated with a more favorable outcome. So it's true clinical translational research.
Is this something that can be done in real time for patients that are, say, coming into your clinic now?
Ultimately, that's the goal. Right now, I think it's still research, and but ultimately, that's the goal.
So you talked about patients who have only a few metastases and that one approach might be, say, to surgically resect those. Can you talk a little bit about that? What is your strategy for those patients? And now how do you make that decision given that you don't have, you know, access to these microRNA data? What's your clinical decision making on that?
So a lot of that has to do with looking at clinical characteristics, and a big part of that has to do with looking at the imaging. A good example for this is colon cancer that has metastasized to the liver. Patients that actually have colon cancer that has metastasized only to the liver and nowhere else should be seen by a surgical oncologist for consideration for surgical resection. We look at characteristics that will allow us to think if we can actually cure the patient, because it's a big surgery and we want to do the surgery if it's going to benefit the patient. So patients with a low number of metastases or metastases that are localized to one aspect of the liver are the candidates that are people that are good candidates for this. And the last thing I must mention is a long disease-free interval.
Dr. Sajid Khan is Assistant Professor of Surgical Oncology at the Yale School of Medicine. If you have questions or comments, we invite you to visit yalecancercenter.org, where you can also get the podcast and find written transcripts of previously broadcast episodes. You're listening to WNPR, Connecticut's public media source for news and ideas.